Good afternoon. This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dark, fresh off his presentation on 60 Minutes Nationwide on CBS last night. Sheriff Dark and the Cook County Jail process 70,000 inmates each year. The great majority are people who are mentally ill and belong to various gangs. Sheriff Dart has been described as a very unconventional sheriff of Cook County. And his topic today that he speaks about, online data privacy, transparency, and cybersecurity, better known as the Right to Know Bill, is legislation that Sheriff Dart is proposing in Springfield during the current session. It has cleared both the House and the Senate committees, but he's not certain if the governor will support the bill. What the bill would deal with is the fact that there are many people who have access to our online data, and the question of cybersecurity is something that most of us do not think of unless it hits us right in our computers when we turn it on and we learn that we have been hacked. So Sheriff Dart talked about some proposed legislation that, in effect, the companies that seek our data would have to let us know that they are taking our personal data, using it for profit, and we must know who has access to the data and how it would affect us. That's what he hopes his legislation that he talked about today will accomplish. So we shall see what will happen, because this is all being battled out down in Springfield and the legislative session.
I want to thank everybody for coming out here today. Issues I'm going to talk about are a little bit different for me, and at some point, if you notice that I'm grabbing John Donovan and asking him to present for me, you'll understand why. This is something that I've found to be a very, very important topic, and not just something that I found on a spare moment I have, because as most people know, between 10,000 detainees in one form or another and five children, I don't have any free time in my life. The point I want to make, though, is how all this sort of fits in here, is that it's very difficult in the present tense where we're at right now to be talking about anything other than the horrific violence that we see going on in our communities. And it's very challenging for everybody involved in the government who's trying to come up with solutions, and particularly in law enforcement, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to try to come up with real ways to change what's going on out there. And so we see that going on. People are attempting to do best they can. But at the same time, our communities are somewhat fractured. There's a lack of trust for law enforcement as well. And so as a result of that, you have crimes that are not being solved as well. People are trying very hard. They're trying their best. But there's a confluence of things right now that is making it inherently very, very difficult. And so from like our perspective in our office, we have looked at it as something where doing the conventional and continuing to try to do the same programs and the same ways to try to, you know, stop and suppress crime, they really aren't the ones that are going to be effective now. And so for quite some time now, we've tried to do things that I think under most people's estimation would be considered to be quite unconventional. And they have been things that have required some people to take a little bit of a leap of faith with me on some of the things I've done, like when I opened up a chicken coop, which, mind you, is definitely one of the ones that did not work out. I really, really did not realize how little I knew about chickens until we went about that one. But so much of what we are doing is an attempt to get at the people that we have in our custody. And well, people will say, well, you know, that will happen down in the prison system. That's not where they end up going. 85% of the people that come into our custody go right back to the community. But yet, sheriffs forever have really not been terribly engaged with trying to fix people coming into their jails, because the thought was they're just there for a little window of time, waiting on their trial. They go off to prison, and that's where they try to fix them and make them better. Well, that has never been the case, and it's never more so than right now. Not only do they come and go straight from the jail to the streets, as I say, 85% of them, but the other reality is, too, is that they're staying with us longer and longer and longer periods of time. I have people in my custody right now who have been waiting for their cases to be disposed of, who have been in my custody 7 years, 8 years, 9 years. And so because of that, it requires us to think differently about what we do. And so in doing that, we have been coming up with programs that some people would, I think, acknowledge are quite unconventional. We have a cooking program by a renowned chef, Chef Bruno Abadi. He's phenomenal. Has some of the wackiest outfits you've ever seen he wears. And he has a passion that he has to try to change people's lives. So he comes into the jail, and he teaches culinary skills. And not just skills that I would understand, like popcorn and macaroni and cheese, but he teaches them the real deal. And so he teaches them that, and it's mind-altering, as you can tell when the participants talk to you about it afterwards. And so they get this obvious skill, but it changes the way they look at things. And the other part of it, too, is we make money for the jail. Instead of coming to the taxpayers, we're getting money for selling this. And Bruno, through Ron Gidwitz, who many of you know, Ron, through the just kindness of his heart, he bought us a wood-burning stove. He and a couple of friends of his came together and bought it. And we make this outrageous pizza now that is not delivered to the dorm rooms of all the inmates, like some people might think. It's something where they can order it with money that they have, and then in doing that, we get more money for the program, and it all works. We run a chess program that is pretty fantastic. We just beat a team via Skype from Brazil last week. And that teaches the detainees not just a skill, you know, chess, but it teaches them about the, you know, this unique way of thinking that many never had, which is that there are consequences to what you do. And you got to plan not just one move, but five moves out. And you can see them as they change, as they're talking about this with other people, about what the program meant to them. And so we have these type of programs. We have farming programs. We have educational programs. We have this one program we just started that is phenomenal, and I can't thank Deborah Gittler enough for it. It's called Contextos, and they're in the jail for free, which is definitely was a big selling point, Deborah. But it's incredible what they're doing. It was a program that's modeled out of a program that Deborah worked on down in Central America, where they were working with the worst of the detainees. So mind you, a lot of the programs I just talked to you about were ones for like medium, minimum inmates that are most likely going right back to the community. The ones who are in there on the more serious offenses will stick with us, cause a great deal of problems within the institution, because once again, they're staying with us for very long periods of time. And so one of the things that we have found is if you program in there, not only do you make it a better environment for the staff, but you make it a better environment for that person. So Deborah's program is fantastic. It teaches them writing skills, literary skills, where it's, I'm not in any way doing it justice here, but they teach them to do this so that the individuals involved with the program write their own memoirs, and then they publish it. And I went to their graduation ceremony recently, and it was just amazing, just mind-blowing. And to hear these individuals talk about it, absolutely incredible. In the living unit Deborah chose, mind you, against everyone's wishes, but that's the one she wanted, was the most difficult. She picked the most difficult. She picked the very tier where we had a hostage situation about 6 months ago, something like that. And that tier where we'd always had problems with detainees has gone from having an incident a day to where they don't have any. Just fantastic. And it's all because of you. So we have those programs. We have a really cool program called SAVE that we invented ourselves that is this way where we target individuals who come into our custody or from the 15 worst, most violent zip codes, target 18 to 20-year-olds from there. They go in this program. We work with them on just loads of skill, anger management skills, obviously, but also a lot of cognitive behavioral programming as well. And in doing that, we work with them for an extended period of time in our custody, but then when they leave us, we connect them to members in the community. And that community connection has been huge. And so the people, we've had about 200 people in the program, but the ones who have left the program and gone back to the community, there's been 32. And mind you, these are all people who have indicators of violence in there. We've only had one charged with a crime of violence, and I'm not trying to minimize it, but it was a domestic violence case. So there was no shootings, there was no robberies, no nothing. And so there's programs that we have in place that are showing a lot of promise. And so I'm not saying that, you know, we're out of the woods, but I'm saying we have a lot of things going that are different, that are something that are a little bit less than usual, and we're having progress there, showing progress. And this, too, mind you, while we're doing something that is really completely unconventional, which is in the area of how we house our worst people. Throughout every jail and prison in the United States of America, they use segregation. They use it all the time. Every single study that has ever been done says it is the worst conceivable thing you can do to a human being. to lock them in a concrete room for 23 hours a day and then to let them out maybe for one to be in a room, a different room by themselves. You can imagine how difficult that would be on most people. Now, when you layer over that, that most of these people are all going back to our communities. What do you think's happening to them? It's horrible. So a year ago, we ended every variation of segregation in our place. And so there's no one in our place, no matter how violent they are, who does not get at least 20% of the day out amongst other people, which is unheard of in corrections. And the result of that, too, the result of that, though, has been less attacks on our staff than ever. And so it was something we felt comfortable, that's where it was going to go, but it's already borne that out and it's shown that. And the staff who have been working on it, absolutely incredible. I mean, we are in the news every once in a while because some of my staff take a lot of holidays. But they are the minority. I have some of the most dedicated, hardworking people in the world, and particularly the ones that worked on this issue in regards to segregation. Absolutely incredible how much they gave, because it was taking a leap of faith on us that we were able to pull this off, and we've been succeeding there. So those things we're doing, we're putting more police officers than we've ever before from the sheriff's office into the city of Chicago to assist them with the violence issues as well. We're doing all those things, but the issue I really want to talk to you about today, and one where unfortunately I'm going to have to use more notes than I traditionally do, but this past week was a very difficult one for the office and a lot of us, because we had a case of a young boy who jumped into the Des Plaines River last week. And so literally the entire office, myself included, we were on the Des Plaines River for the whole week. And unfortunately, he did not survive, but we were able to recover his body. But it was the whole office was involved with this. So it was something where I might be a little bit more choppy than normal. So for that, I want to apologize up front for you. But the issue, as I said, the one that Mike referenced, that he's been so helpful in Springfield, and Art Turner's been a great help as well, is something I felt really strongly about, because while issues of violence and things like that appropriately get a lot of attention from people, there's other more benign things that are going on around us as we sit here right now that can be not as dangerous as the violence, but undercutting a lot of the very principles that make us so unique, make us a country that so many people talk about because of our individual freedoms and our ability to have privacy and not have government all over us and knowing everything and anything we do. And so it happens in a time where, you know, you think about it, technology, whenever that word comes up, it's always positive. Everyone's always talking about the latest advancement, you know, the latest app, the latest way our life has been made easier for us. And this is all good. That part is all good. But no one ever really sits there and talks about, you know, what else is going on at that same time while all these great things are going on around us. And when you think about it, I don't know if a day goes by that you don't hear about the latest privacy breach. So whether it's an individual who had their financial data stolen or they've had personal information put up, it's going on everywhere. It's happening to virtually every company you can imagine and virtually every governmental entity you can think of as well. Just like a week ago or so, the ransomware hit all throughout the world. It didn't hit us, but hit everywhere else pretty hard. And we have seen that even at the jail, where people have attempted to do that as well. So while the benefits of the technology world are so immense and so great, what else is going on, though? What are we giving up to have this? And that's the point that we started talking about within our own office, because it has more than just a theoretical connection to the office. I'll never forget, about 4 years ago, I got a phone call from the Bulgarian consulate. Okay, not a place I traditionally get a lot of calls from. Immediately, I assumed that we had screwed something up, but on a more international scale than normal. So I met with them, and much to my joy, I found out that it wasn't that they were actually thanking us, because we had uncovered a financial crime scheme where individuals who were Bulgarian nationals had this scheme where they put these devices inside ATM machines and they were taking people's information and so on and so forth. And we had broke it up. And so they wanted to thank us. But in doing that, they wanted to sort of open our eyes into just the breadth of financial crimes. And they gave me a little bit, as a history major, gave me a little bit of a 101 about the breakdown of the Soviet Union and about how certain parts of the Soviet Union were more specialized in tech than others and so on. And in doing that, they made it abundantly clear to me, in no uncertain terms, that while we might be thinking we're on the cutting edge in law enforcement and trying to catch up to this financial crime, we are easily 5, 6, 7 years behind it, absolutely behind it. And they constantly wanted us to come out to their capital, Sophia, to do these meetings on the financial crime stuff. Apparently that's outside of the Cook County region, and I only drive, so I had to turn them down. But we Skyped it, and during that, they had experts from all around the country there who were just blowing our mind, and that's just how vulnerable we all are. And at the end of the day, when we asked them, you know, what is it that we can do to protect ourselves, they said very little. They said all you can do is be more aware of what information you have, where it's at, and who can access it. And so that was what they told us. And in telling that, what as a country do we do? We do the exact opposite. I mean, you think about it. I mean, do you know anybody that doesn't put, like, virtually every private thing they have on their own Facebook account? I mean, we as a country want to tell everybody about everything. And so we have exposed ourselves more so than probably anybody to all sorts of problems because of these great things, this great thing called technology. I'm going to talk more about this, but I really felt that some actual live victims, you know, stories would probably drive this home a little bit more. Because there's so many of them, it was more a question of which ones we want to sort through. But there was a couple of them that really, I think, drove it home more so than anything else about what it is that is the problem here. And so I was going to talk about some of the victims here, but one other just point of reference, too, while we're talking about this. Think about this for a second. When we are pursuing a criminal, so somebody that we have probable cause to believe has committed a crime, for us to get that person's phone and their phone records, we, the law enforcement agency, has to go to the state's attorney's office to draw up a search warrant, who then take it to a grand jury who sign off on it. If they sign off, it's then sent to the provider, the phone company. The phone company then sends it back to the grand jury. The grand jury then analyzes it if it's appropriate, gives it back to the state's attorney. If they believe it's appropriate, then we get the information. That's what we do for criminals. But for the rest of us, the non-criminals, that very same type of information is being taken without us even knowing it. On a regular basis, we have no idea what information is being taken from us, what it's being used for, is it being sold, given away. And when you hear these stories, you'll understand how this stuff can impact all of our lives. The one in particular I wanted to just talk about at the outset was a gentleman named Richard Guthrie. And this is Richard here. At the time of the photo, this is May 2007. He was a 92-year-old veteran of the United States Army living in Iowa. He's a senior citizen and was a victim of a data scam that resulted in the loss of all of his life savings. In the twilight of his life, he became the victim like millions because his name, his personal data, things as simple as his name, was sold by a large, unregulated, unaccountable data brokerage company. And in the case of Mr. Guthrie, the purchaser of his name happened to be the wrong kind of person was the one who purchased it. And as I say, I'm breaking on some of these terms, a data broker is a company that purchases, collects, or sells consumers' private personal information, more often than not without the consumer knowing it, or certainly not having consented to it. The data brokerage sold Mr. Guthrie's data and the data of other would-be victims to telemarketing criminals who then used it to garner financial and banking information through scams, emptying the unsuspecting victim's bank accounts of everything. Data brokers commonly sell lists of data that they acquire, and the lists are often extremely targeted. If you look at this slide here, behind me now, you'll see examples of some lists the data brokerage companies had for sale at the time of Mr. Guthrie's story, as well as the prices attached to them in the descriptions as well. The telemarketing criminals easily acquired Mr. Guthrie's personal information from a data company, and after receiving it, they targeted his phone number with the ultimate objective being the acquisition of his banking and financial information. So the criminals can use this to try to get into the personal finances of individuals, and it's one of their MOs. In the case of Mr. Guthrie, the criminals created unsigned checks, and they found a bank then that was willing to accept and cash them. When interviewed years after the scam, Mr. Guthrie said, I can't understand why they were allowed inside my account. I just chatted with this woman for a few minutes, and the next thing I knew, they took everything I had. It all looks initially, these folks, they try to gain access through trying to gain people's trust, but they were able to do this because they had gained this information. And by doing that, this 92-year-old gentleman lost everything he had. I wish, as I said, that I could say something good happened out of this. No, they recovered less than 20% of what he lost. Everything he had, everything he worked for was gone. And all of this was a result of personal information, as tiny as a name or phone number, having been collected and sold for large profits, by the way, by a corporation who then put the information into a wrong person's hands. The next one individual I want to show you, though, demonstrates how quickly all this also has another hook to it. So this woman here, her name is coming up here any second now. This involves like personal data in regards to the employment area and criminal histories as well. I'm just going to start reading this because it's just a photograph, actually. This woman, her name is Kathleen Casey. She's from Boston, and in 2010, she, like many other people, were facing some financial difficulties, so she was out looking for a job, and she applied for a job. She was hopeful the job at the time that she applied for was something that she was going to be able to acquire. In many areas of the world now, people do background checks of folks prior to hiring them. It's quite routine, and it's very appropriate in many, many cases. The employers alone were spending at least $2 billion a year to look into prospective employees through background checks and things like that. You know, it's obviously that it's the right thing to do in many, many cases. But the problem is the way the searches are going now, they're horribly, horribly flawed because some of the people that are selling, background check information are grabbing data from all over, and it's not being checked, cross-checked, and analyzed. And it's basically through scraping through the internet people's names and pulling that together and putting it into a file. And at times it's incredibly reckless. And Kathleen is an example of just how that is, because these computers will scrape public records all across the country in order to retrieve personal data, and they combine the data with other information that they already bought from a different place to put together this file on a person. And as I mentioned, the problem is the stuff is really not checked and vetted. So in Ms. Casey's case, she was denied a job by an employer because of her criminal history. Well, it turns out the criminal history was for a completely different person who was 20 years younger than her, had a different middle name, and also had recently been charged with a 14-count indictment for larceny. So she was denied the job, and there's no happy ending. She wasn't able to get the job. So this is something that obviously for purposes of hiring is beyond tragic, but then think about reputationally as well, how often people might not even be aware their reputations are being sullied because someone has got a file on them, a personnel file, that isn't inaccurate, that isn't even them. The ability to commercially scrape data from the internet presents everyday dangers given how much information we put out each day about ourselves. But the dangers exist even when we do not put it out, because companies and criminals often employ a practice called pretexting, where they will take available scraped information and use it as a pretext to obtain other more detailed sensitive information. And this next case we're going to talk about was where they were able to grab information, and it was horribly tragic. So this is Amy Boyer. She was a 20-year-old dental assistant from New Hampshire, who had family, friends, and a great life. The other individual who is in this picture, his name is Liam Eunice, and he was a very troubled person who the media reports said that he was deranged, suicidal, demented. He praised the Columbine killers, blogged about his suicidal fantasies and shooting rampages, and he talked about his love for his AR-15 and his hatred of classmates and colleagues. Amy and Liam happened to attend the same high school together, and despite his hatred for his classmates, he had an infatuation for her. Liam contacted an information brokerage company and an internet-based investigation and information service, which is simply another name for saying the data brokerage company. So they pulled together this information. And he requested Amy's date of birth, social security number, and employment information. The company was unable to provide her date of birth, but the company obtained her social security number from a credit reporting agency and provided that to him for $45. the company obtained Amy's work address by having a subcontractor place a pretext call to Amy, similar to the calls placed to Mr. Guthrie, to obtain this information. The subcontractor lied about their true identity and purpose for the call in order to convince Amy to reveal her employment information. They pretended to be affiliated with her insurance company and requested verification of Amy's work address in order to facilitate an overpayment refund. The data brokerage company charged Ewens $109 for that information. So for $109 and the $45, he got the employment information and he got her Social Security number. And so he purchased those. About 4 months after he purchased all this data, he drove to Amy's workplace and fatally shot her as she left her work. He had driven there, parked his car, waited until she had gotten out, and just as he had said he was going to do on the blog, he shot her 11 times and killed her. Amy's family eventually sued one of the companies involved, and they were able to receive all of $85,000 for this horrific event. All these different stories, and as I say, I had a lot more, but Jay took all my time. But they have some clear connections and patterns in there that you have to really be focused on. They all involve the collection of personal data for profit. They all involve the either selling or sharing of the personal information with a third party by a data brokerage for profit. They all involve collection, selling, or sharing of data with little to no knowledge of it by the person whose data is at issue. And they all have, in these cases, all had very tragic endings as a result of just how unregulated this is. You have one conclusion, you walk away from this. The collection and disclosure of our personal data has real impacts, and that's why it's imperative to us to know what of us is out there and who has access to it and what people are doing with it. You're probably asking yourself, how did all this data brokerage and getting this data in the first place? We have this little exercise that we're going to actually have people go through here today to give you an idea of just what is out there these days. And so we're going to use – anybody have iPhone out there now? I know. Yeah, now give me all your personal information. No. I have my county flip phone. Now, seriously, if you can walk with me through this, and I'm going to do this slow for a myriad of good reasons, not the least of which that's the only way I can do it, but this is an exercise that's going to show you basically, not to scare you, but to give you an idea of how easy it is for just people to pull information based on just your phone and where you've been located. Okay, so let's see. All right, go to the settings application, okay? So go to your settings application. CJ, I told you this would be fun, interactive, you know? Okay, while you're at the settings application, scroll down and go to the third section and click the last line of the section that reads privacy. Okay. Now, click the first line that reads location services. Okay, within location services, scroll down and click on the line that reads system services. All right. Next, scroll down to the end of the first section and find the line that reads frequent locations and click on it. Now, this is where it sort of gets interesting. Click any location line underneath history. Here you'll find all of the locations that your phone has been tracking you. Now, you can click any line on this page, and you will find all of the dates, times, and durations that you spent at these locations. You're a little creeped out. I don't blame you. And yeah, as I say, you might want to disengage this function, but when you do that, you lose other options, you know, of things you can do. So I'm not necessarily advocating for this, but at the end of the day, this ties into the legislation that Mike's got in Springfield for us that we're trying to address by just making people aware of all of the ways that people are having their information put out there and what people can do with it. So you can really, your imagination can run with it as far as knowing what people could do with this information if they got it. All right, now I've upset everyone. Exactly. Yeah, I know. So that was an effort to show you just about how every one of your phones that you have right now is basically tracking you, just that one part of it. So just the location part of it. Something that there's another bill in Springfield, not ours, but another great bill on geolocation that also gives people the ability to know if they're being located, if people are using that information, the whole nine yards. It's got a similar strain to what our bill does. Much like with that, you know, so iPhones are ubiquitous. You know, Facebook. Everyone is aware of Facebook, and many people other than me use it. And that's all good and fine. But if you've ever wondered how much of your personal information can be gleaned from something as simple as a single like on a Facebook post, watch this video. It's really fascinating.
Chocolate.
What's the name?
Joel.
What was the name?
Alex.
Thank you. There you go, Johnny.
Cheers. If you like our Facebook page, we give you a free hot drink and a free pastry.
We have a new life for Damien.
Standing by.
Hi there, can I help?
Yeah, just liked your Facebook page.
Okay, I'll search Facebook now.
I'm searching Google.
I have a phone number.
I've got his email address.
Okay, Carly, are you ready
for information on Damien?
Yep, I am.
Mother's maiden name is... He banks with...
Hey, Carly, this is the girl coming in now with the blue scarf.
What's her name?
Nicholas.
His date of birth, 7th of May. She lives at 38A.
Just pick up a second.
Two children, aged 4 and 6. Previous address. She's got the photo.
Yeah, got it. Damien, age 26 and a fitness instructor.
How do you know that?
Brody, who goes to UCL. Martin, who went to South Thames College. Assistant psychologist at Great Ormond Street.
How did you know?
That's just... I don't
really
understand.
Oh,
well. You know I'm a Christian as well.
Oh, yeah, we know everything about you, Martin. Thank you. Nice to meet you, Anna from Russia.
Okay, so that video you just watched is called Data to Go, and it was published by a British-based nonprofit called CFIS. And CFIS focuses on fraud prevention. They introduced this video in order to raise public awareness about the importance of managing online privacy settings. The footage is from last March. The group put a sign outside the coffee shop that promised a free coffee and croissant to any customer who liked the cafe's Facebook page. And when customers entered the cafe, they were asked for their first name when they ordered their free coffee. As you saw, while they waited for their order, a team of data researchers spent 3 minutes searching for information about them on public websites, such as their age, occupation, and then communicated that information to the barista via a headset. The video clearly showed all the data that can be made accessible for something as simple as a single like on a Facebook page. Your first name, the length of time it takes to order a cup of coffee, all those things they can do things with. That is all it took to gather an enormous amount of sensitive personal data that can be used in many different ways, including to personally harm people, as we have seen in some of these other examples here. Your exposure isn't just from your iPhone or social media accounts, in case you were thinking that you're out of the woods. It is also happening with the websites that you visit every day. When you go to a website, you think you're just interacting with that website, but thanks to third-party data collectors, you're not. Through the use of an add-on tool called Lightbeam, we were able to shine a light on the plethora of hidden third-party collectors who, despite being hidden, are actually collecting loads of data while you're using the website. This one I found to be absolutely fascinating here, because this one, for an individual like me who routinely will pull up the Tribune or the Sun-Times on my laptop while I'm at work, it shows you that while you're doing that, what else is going on. So we visited four random websites. We picked the Weather Channel, Time Magazine, People, and AARP, and then ran this light beam program, this add-on tool that's exclusive to Firefox. As you can see from the slide behind me, Lightbeam showed that while I thought I was only visiting four websites, there were 188 hidden third-party sites that were accessing and collecting my data. We didn't visit any of these third-party websites during the search. That was nothing we had done. And nobody notified us that they were actively collecting during our time on the website that we chose to visit. If you look closely, you can see that Twitter, Google, and Yahoo are all among the third-party sites that were actively accessing and collecting data through our time on the four websites we chose, even despite the fact that we hadn't accessed them and were not logged into any of them. Now, just imagine how often this is taking place by countless companies secretly collecting your data in the background through your computer, phone, tablet, and all without your knowledge while you're using another site altogether different. It's something we talked about this one. It's something to think about next time you're on WebMD, which, by the way, Lightbeam told us is connected to at least 21 third-party sites. So if you're going there to look up the medical condition you heard about, or if you had a loved one, you were trying to look up something and researching that, people are accessing the fact that you're on that website looking for a certain thing. So, those ones are, pretty much hidden from view. These other two, I was just going to reference briefly because, once again, Jay took all my time. The next two, these were sort of news flashes to me, and John had to hold my hand through this one. These are called IoT, the Internet of Things. And so through those, they have these devices that they refer to them as exposed devices. And so this is advanced now to where household devices are able to track, log, and share all sorts of information about our lives. In just the past few years alone, an increasing number of everyday devices such as phones, television, cars, toys, and home appliances have evolved into smart or connected devices. And this is what it means when we're talking about the Internet of Things, that these things are all connected as well. A recent trend micro study reported that ZDNet highlights this concern, as the study found that in major U.S. cities there are over 170 million exposed IoT devices, including over 2.5 million exposed devices in Chicago alone. This is a remarkable statistic and should concern everyone that owns an Alexa, Google Home, or the like. The exposed devices all contain personal data on their users, and many of them have likely shared that data with some hidden third-party companies, and many likely did so without the express knowledge or understanding of the user and the rightful owner. As you said, we've already talked about this stuff in the wrong person's hands can be so, devastating on so many different levels. There was a recent case in regards to a company called Cloud Pets, which is a company that makes stuffed animals for children that features built-in microphones and speakers so that the children can record messages onto stuffed toys such as a teddy bear, and then they can send the message to their parents. Unbeknownst to these consumers, the children's recordings were left wide open on the Internet with no password protection, allowing massive amounts of sensitive information to potentially fall into the hands of criminals. Hackers were able to access information, copy recordings, and in some cases they held the children's recordings ransom, and people had to pay to get them back. Think about that for a moment. A child records a message on their favorite stuffed animal, and the message is stolen and held for ransom. For the person who has been harmed by these acts, virtually nothing they can do. And so what we came up with was the Right to Know Bill, and it was something, as I said, John's been working on tirelessly this entire session, and I found it hilarious. I go to the comics first, and then things get bad after that. And my kids pointed this one out to me, though, and it just so clearly summarized exactly what we're talking about. For the people that wander around acting as if no one's aware of any aspect of their life, that's just not true. We are giving up more and more and more data, and we don't even realize it. And so The bill that I've been referencing here is important in and of itself, but it's even more important than it ever was, because the brain surgeons in Washington now have gone about rolling back what little transparency there is. And this is something that's it's been just astounding what they're up to there. Because, I mean, if you talk about all the problems that we have in this world and the things that we need them to be working on in Washington, rolling back protections for people on the Internet was not one of them, was on anyone's list. And yet that's what they've done. And so the federal government rolled back privacy protection for consumers. And it was just last week the FCC took the first step to overturn net neutrality. So while that's going on, we came up with our bill. But our bill, as I said, we were doing it because we felt very strongly about the issue. We knew we were onto the right thing here. But it was amazing when people started polling this information. But once again, as I said, when you look at how out of touch these folks were in Washington and doing this, there's all sorts of polls we've all seen and we've all heard of them. This is one of those ones that's not like a real close call. It's like 94% of Illinoisan consumers disapprove of corporations collecting, sharing, or selling personal data. 80% of Illinois consumers would use the law to request names of companies that have obtained their personal data. I mean, the numbers in these polls that have come out are just astounding. If there's one thing on all ends of the spectrum we all seem to agree on, is we want to have our privacy, and we should. We should have it, and it's something I think we all believe we do have, but the problem is we don't. And therein lies the problem. And this is like the national side of it. 95% are concerned about business collecting and selling their personal information. It's just the numbers are astounding. And so our bill could not be any more straightforward, honest to goodness. It literally says that all these companies have to do is they have to have a place on their site where an individual can go to that they can contact them by email or by phone and say, ask them, what information of mine are you collecting and who are you selling or giving it away to? And so that is literally what the bill says. I consider it to be quite a modest effort to try to give us all some more privacy back. The companies involved with it, though, opposing this, are just, it's stunning. I mean, the amount of time and money that they've put into this, and these are all the big, big hitters are involved with it. And they're doing everything they can to try to kill this bill. I don't know their exact motives. I would suggest to you strongly it probably has something to do with the fact when you can get all this information for free, as I mentioned before to you, the very information that law enforcement cannot get unless we have a warrant, information that they're accumulating for free that they can sell and monetize for all these different purposes, there's a real reason why they don't want people to do that. Now, at the end of the day, what our bill says, it doesn't mean that you have to get authorization from people. What it says is you have to inform people. So then if people know this information, they know there's like two similar companies and one takes your data and sells it, the other one doesn't, then the consumer can go and, you know, show what they want to do by going to that company. And so we've been fighting this incredibly difficult battle down in Springfield through Mike's efforts and John and Art Turner. We've been able to get bills out of both chambers. We don't know what's going to happen with them at the end, but it's something where, as I say, we've had the big hitters against us, but the small tech companies, they're all with us. They're all on board with what we're doing here. And we've had incredible support from the Digital Privacy Alliance, the Public Interest Research Group of Illinois, Social Change, the Liberty Project, the West Side Justice Center, the ACLU, the Center for Democracy and Technology, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Consumer Federation of America, and quite a few more. But as I said, virtually every small company you can think of is supporting us and what we're doing here. And, you know, as I mentioned, though this issue, rightfully so, does not get the attention of the violence that we have going on in Chicago right now, it's imperative that we start addressing this issue while we still have some privacy left. You think about it, it's our own individual privacy that really makes us human, makes us who we are. And if we aren't aware of this and we aren't aware how this is slowly slipping away from us, it's going to be too late, folks. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheriff Dart. Don't go away. So we have very little time for questions because Jay took all of our time. Shame on you, Jay. We're not going to go through these. Happy birthday, Sheriff Dart.
Thank you, sir.
And here's a question. Where's the governor on this?
I have not heard from him, but I haven't heard from him since he became governor, so that's nothing new. So I'm not real sure. I've been getting some information that he's not supportive of this effort right now. So we're pretty confident because, as I say, the work in the Senate with Mike and then the House with Art, we're doing really well there, but I'm not optimistic where the governor's going to be on this.
Okay. Latrice, if you come over here.